In 1965, 49 years after his execution, Roger Casement's remains were returned to Dublin and laid to rest with full state honours in Dublin's Glasnevin Cemetery.
Yes, the remains are now approaching the junction of Abbey Street.
A man once branded a traitor by the British Crown, Casement's life was one of intrigue, humanitarianism and rebellion. From his groundbreaking work exposing the atrocities of colonialism in the Congo and the Amazon to his involvement in the Easter Rising.
His chief wish was that when they had finished with him there, his body would be permitted to be brought back to his own motherland. That was his chief desire. He asked nothing more than that his body should not rest in that foreign soil.
I'm joined now by Casement's most recent biographer, Roland Phillips, whose book, Broken Archangel, The Tempestuous Lives of Roger Casement, was published earlier this year. First off, Roland, what attracted you to Casement as a subject? I mean, he's a risky subject. He's been covered so often and so extensively before.
I've always been fascinated by Casement without knowing that much about him. And when I was thinking about, as the whole world is, rethinking the colonial past and the imperial past, I became re-interested in him because he was a person involved in decolonizing or humanitarian acts ahead of his time. So that rekindled my interest in him. And when I started reading about him, I felt it's time there's a modern look at Casement. He's such a modern man with his humanitarian aspects, let alone the sexuality and different attitudes to that. And I realised that there was space for a modern look at this extraordinary man.
He was born in 1864, that's 160 years ago this month. Tell us a bit about his early life, about his background. He's somebody I must say I always associate with County Antrim, but it appears he was born in Dublin.
He was born in Dublin, left Dublin at a very young age. One of the things that struck me about Casement was his need to have a cause always at his centre, which I sort of track back to his childhood, because although he was born in Dublin, he left at a very young age. He was the youngest of four children. His mother was, an alcoholic. She died of cirrhosis of the liver, died when he was about nine. His father is a strange figure, possibly also alcoholic, who gave up a commission in his Indian Army regiment. The family lived this strange peripatetic life. They left Ireland when Roger was very young. They moved from boarding house to boarding house around the suburbs of London. They maybe had a spell in Jersey. So it was a sort of rootless upbringing. And he didn't go to live in Antrim until he was 13, when his father was mortally ill. And then he was taken in by his uncles near Ballycastle, the uncles who had sent his father £5 a year. His father seems to me to be a sort of remittance man. His few letters survived to his uncles asking for £5 to be sent to him here and there. So Casement didn't actually visit Ireland, as far as I can see, until he was 12 or 13 years old.
Strange question it might seem, but what kind of accent would he have had, given that peripatetic background?
He had a straightforward English accent. When he went to Germany in the war to try and recruit Irish soldiers into an Irish brigade, the Irish soldiers could not believe he was claiming to be Irish, because he sounded like an Englishman. He was called Sir Roger. Everything was stacked against him.
Tell me about his physical appearance. I would assume from looking at photographs of him that he was a very, very striking-looking man.
He was 6 foot four, three or four, very handsome. He had a marvellous voice, people do comment on. It had a very rich timbre. And no one who saw him forgot him, because he was so good-looking and imposing in his height.
Now, one of the things that you cover wonderfully in the book is his early years in the Congo, something that I must say I wasn't particularly familiar with. This is long before his work with the Foreign Office. And, the Congo is a big place, but he shared it with William Morton Stanley and Joseph Conrad.
Yes, he went there on the shipping company that looked after the Congo shipping. he joined in Liverpool. He worked there as a clerk. He longed to get away. I think, again, partly a product of this background, that he didn't feel at home anywhere. So he went to the Congo aged 18 as a purser on a ship, and then shortly afterwards decided to settle there. And he worked for Stanley. He worked in building, surveying, and the building of the railway in the Congo, which was essential to get goods to the sea. And it's quite shadowy, but he did a bit of ivory trading. He wrote a couple of letters home to his relatives in Ballycastle, not really saying what he was doing. But I think he had a variety of jobs, partly exploration with Stanley. And then the first real sighting of him is when Joseph Conrad, who was then had his Polish name and hadn't published a word, went to be a steamboat captain on a ship called Le Roi des Belges. And on his second day, Conrad's second day in the Congo, he met Roger Casement, and they spent 3 weeks together. And Conrad wrote in his diary about how in command he seemed, how much he knew about the Congo. He'd been there 6 years by then, Casement. And the stories he told Conrad mentions, and the things he has seen. I think that Casement, who was aware of some of the atrocities, although not yet working against them, probably was an influence on Heart of Darkness in those stories he was telling Conrad.
So in other words, Casement, long before he begins to work for the Foreign Office, is already well aware of the activities taking place in the name of Le Roi des Belges, the King of the Belgians, Leopold. But tell me how he then begins his investigation, produces his report on human rights abuses for the Foreign Office.
10 years after this Conrad appearance, he becomes a consul, and at that point, the atrocities are quite well hidden. There are very few Europeans allowed to work in the Congo, in the Belgian Congo. And I think part of Casement's motivation for becoming a consul was that it meant he could stay there, he could travel. He also worked in a mission station early on, and the missionaries were the only people who really got to hear about the atrocities because they weren't under Belgian oversight. And Roger Casement became a consul, I think partly with in mind that he could do some good. And when these reports began to filter out of the mission stations in the early 1900s, it made sense for the British government to ask their consul to produce a report in order to settle what was happening. And the great thing is that because Casement had been there such a long time, he spoke some of the languages. He went further up the Congo than any non-Belgian European had been, I think, for about 10 years, and interviewed some of these terribly mutilated people. They'd had their hands cut off for not collecting enough rubber. They'd had to play dead while this was happening to them. There were stories of villages decimated and just appalling things. And because Casement knew his ground so well, they trusted him and told him their stories, which they'd shied away from telling anyone else, enabling him to produce, in a terrible fit of rage and misery, to produce his report that changed the world. It enabled the European powers who'd sanctioned King Leopold of the Belgians to run the Congo in 1885, it persuaded them that things had to change, and there was a huge international movement, not quick enough for Casement's liking, to get it removed from Leopold's control, which happened 4 or 5 years after his report. So it precipitated an international diplomatic push.
Now, the Congo, because of his background there, could be considered a kind of a home fixture. What happens then in Peru, the Putumayo region investigation, very much an away fixture? He doesn't have a background in South America. How does he come to go and investigate human rights abuses there?
After his Congo report was published in 1904, he spent some time in Ireland, which is when he first became interested in Irish cultural nationalism. But then he needed a job. He'd been a consul, so he became a consul in South America. There was a company called the Peruvian Amazon Rubber Company, which at that time was the largest company on the London Stock Exchange. It had floated at something like £1.5 million, huge amount of money in those days. And not only that, but it also provided some 90-something percent of Britain's rubber, which was in huge demand then because of automobiles and cabling, electrical cabling. And reports began to filter back from their rubber workers in the Putumayo region about this. And this company, because it was so important and sensitive to Britain, they thought they'd send their best person, who was Casement. They knew it would be Casement because of his Congo report a few years earlier. So he was known to be able to analyse very, very difficult and appalling situations. So that was why he was sent up the Amazon to investigate this company. He found worse things than he'd seen in the Congo. He heard stories of babies being thrown into bonfires in front of their parents, people who didn't collect enough rubber, men and women being put in the stocks in the blazing sun and then being beaten between their legs. Just unthinkably awful things from this company that was in law a British company, but run by a pair of Peruvian brothers who were unspeakable.
What was the impact then of the second Casement report?
The second Casement report was a very sensitive thing. The immediate impact was it changed British law as to what directors of companies could and couldn't know what was going on. They had to know what was going on. But it meant that they were able to subtly sort of remove the company from the Aranis brothers, they were called. Without them, the danger was they would declare it bankrupt, and not only would this be a terrible financial loss, but it would also mean they could have no further control over it. But so Casement, when he got back to London, after his report was published, he went to a lot of board meetings, and subtly and slowly, the company was removed before it went bankrupt from the brothers. And it made Casement a great hero. I mean, he was already an international hero, probably more than in Britain. But for this work, because it was so sensitive, he was knighted, he was feted in Britain. But it also had the effect, these two journeys had the effect of making him loathe imperialism, loathe the Foreign Office establishment. They were a clubby bunch who'd all been to Oxford and Cambridge, and they rather looked down on this man who'd left school at 15 and had this rather ill-defined life in the Congo. So the combined experience, it brought Casement fame and acclaim and honours, but left him loathing the British establishment.
So between the Congo and Peru, he becomes a cultural nationalist. When does he begin to become involved politically in Irish nationalist activities?
His Peruvian report was 1911, and immediately after that, really. So he comes back from Peru, he settles in Antrim. It's the time of the Ulster Crisis, and he is appalled at Carson and co. setting up the Ulster Volunteers, and he's a founder of the Irish Volunteer Movement. So he throws himself fully into Irish nationalism.
Let's move on then to his mission to Germany. But just to go back a little bit, tell me about his involvement with Adler Christensen.
Adler Christensen was a Norwegian sailor. He was 24 when Casement met him in the summer of 1914. So after Casement, he does a lot of recruiting for the Irish Volunteers, and he sets up the gun running, the Erskine Childers gun running, that takes place in the summer of 1914. But he, by the time the yacht comes in with the guns, he's already gone. He's gone to America to fundraise in June 1914. And very soon after he gets to America, he meets on Broadway, I don't know who accosted whom, this 24-year-old Norwegian sailor Casement doesn't know he's married and got a child in Philadelphia. He's described as a fleshy, dissipated-looking man. But Adler Christensen becomes the only romantic relationship in Roger Casement's life. And it's an extraordinary story of both love and betrayal, and it defines, I think, his emotions for the last years of his life.
Was Christensen a British intelligence asset right from the start?
No. Christensen was duplicitous from the start, but not a British intelligence asset. What happens is the fundraising dries up because the First World War, or the Great War, is fast approaching and starts. Britain declares war in August, right at the beginning of August 1914. And at that point, his mission to America, his fundraising mission, is pointless because people have other things on their minds. So he comes up with a scheme encouraged by German diplomats in America to go to Germany and to recruit from the Irish prisoners of war in Germany, recruit a brigade. The German government will arm. They're very happy to arm this brigade and provide officers for, to invade Ireland during the war, because Home Rule has been suspended for the duration of the war. And Casement is very, very worried that if Germany win the war, Ireland will never be independent, because it'll be bundled together with the mainland of Great Britain, and that'll be the end of Home Rule. So he is determined to separate Ireland out during the war. So he sets sail under an assumed name with Adler Christensen, who is his servant, acting as his servant and is his actual servant, and they go to Norway, to Adler Christensen's home country. And on the first day in Norway, we can tell, because Casement starts a German diary, and he writes on that first day that he sends Adler Christensen out to do some shopping, and Christensen comes back in a great state, saying he's been accosted in the hotel lobby by a man who then bundles him into a big car and rushes him off to this grand house and offers him money in order to see Casement's correspondence. And they say, we know who you're travelling with. So that's the story as Casement knows it. But a search in the National Archives in England has the documents from the Norwegian legation, where this rather puzzled clerk describes this Norwegian turning up and saying, I want to tell you all about Casement. And interestingly, on his first telegram home, it says, I suspect them of having unnatural relations. And then he's crossed that out, so that didn't arrive in the telegram. So Christensen was actually betraying Casement off his own bat. He wasn't acting as an agent for MI5 in that they didn't turn him, he turned himself. But what's extraordinary about the story is that Casement knew he was under suspicion. It made him paranoid because he thought the British were out to get him. And of course, as this was the very Foreign Office he'd worked for years, he felt truly betrayed. And as the story developed, it became one of paranoid depression and terrible mental health.
How many people would have known about Casement's sexuality prior to the dissemination of the Black Diaries in 1916?
It appears that nobody knew about it. He was very close to his cousin, Gertrude Bannister, who had no idea. One of his brothers often wrote to him and said, isn't it high time you got married? And his sexuality expressed itself from the few diaries we have, and of course they became contentious later on, in a series of encounters for paid sex, paid and fleeting sex. He never seems to have, maybe he didn't want to, but he doesn't seem to have, didn't have any romantic relationships. It was a simple series of paid assignations. And, yeah, nobody had a clue.
His attempt to recruit an Irish brigade in Germany obviously was not successful. Was it ever feasible, do you think?
I don't think so. Some of the soldiers who he went to see. The Germans gathered together all the prisoners of war. There were about 2,500 at that early stage in war, Irish prisoners of war. Casement travelled to talk to them and lecture them. And their reports that came up in Casement's trial made it quite plain that they were rather baffled by this man. I've said earlier that he appeared to them English. But that aside, he took such a romantic view of Irish history. He would talk to them about the ancient kings of Ulster and things that went completely over their head. But also, as one of them said, our families were getting our pay, which was why we joined up in the first place. They weren't conscripted men. So we were safe. Our families were getting our pay. We chose to join up. My best friend was killed by the Germans fighting alongside me. I mean, for all these reasons, it could never have been a success. And I think it was a delusion, really, that it could work.
Now, when he gets on board a submarine, a German submarine that comes back to Ireland just in advance of the 1916 Rising, is it the case that he was coming back to prevent the Rising from taking place?
That's absolutely right. He realized, because he only had 15, 20 men who had signed up, and I think some of them probably were just looking for a free ticket home and would have absconded the moment they got back. The Germans had lost interest in him. The German high-ups were appalled by Adler Christensen and kept urging Casement to get rid of him, but Casement didn't. But Adler Christensen had gone back to America by this point with his German wife he met there in Germany, his bigamous wife. And Casement, who had spent the few months before his return on Good Friday 1916 in a sanatorium, he was very, very unwell, realised that without proper German support and German arms, the Rising could never work. And if it didn't work, it might set the cause back for a very long time. So he persuaded the Germans to send him on a U-boat in order to stop the Rising happening.
On what legal grounds, when he's captured in Bannerstrand, is he then removed to Britain? And does his trial take place not in Ireland, not arguably in Kerry, but in London?
He's first of all arrested because he and the two men, Irishmen, who came back with him had revolvers, pistols with them. So his initial arrest is for bringing arms into Ireland. He's arrested on Good Friday, so the Easter Rising hasn't happened. And he's taken to London for questioning, really, because I think they can't work out what to do with him. Remember, the military trials of the other Irish rebel leaders have not taken place. And when he gets to London, of course, he's a sensitive subject because he is a very distinguished man. He is initially put in the Tower of London, and it's a shocking treatment. He's still in his salt-encrusted clothes. He's waded ashore in Bannerstrand Inn. And initially, he's sent to the Tower of London and will be having a military trial. So now, after the Easter Rising and the leaders have their own military trial and the executions happen. But this is a real problem because a lot of people greatly admire him and respect him. And if he has a military trial, it first of all would have to be in Ireland, and he'd probably be executed. And the government in London are very concerned that this will not play well, and that if he has a civil trial, he will at least, the press will be allowed in, and there will be a jury deciding his fate. But the thing he's tried on is high treason, and high treason trials always take place in London.
When he was on trial for high treason in London, he was at odds with his defence team, was he not, as to the nature of that defence?
Yes. First of all, he found it very hard to get a defence team because no London barrister would defend him. And he gets an Irish barrister, a man called Sergeant Sullivan, and an American lawyer who isn't allowed to speak in court comes over for him. There's a terrific fundraising for his defence. Sir Arthur Conan Doyle gives a lot of money, and many other people who believe in him. And he doesn't really have a defence. He wants to make a great speech, and Bernard Shaw encourages him to write a speech indeed for him, pleading his case as an Irishman and that the court is illegitimate. And it's really a martyr's speech. He knows he can't win. And he makes a version of that speech after he's condemned to death, and it's the most powerful thing he ever writes, in my opinion. But it's a hopeless defence case. There's no question that he's performed high treason with the king's enemies, because he's been in Germany negotiating to invade Ireland. In the end, his defence and the appeal is run are left appealing, as Casement says, I may be being hanged on a comma, onto whether there's a comma in the statute which would affect whether or not his you can do treason outside the realm. And this is their only line of defence, and it doesn't work. I mean, it's such a disaster in that his barrister, Sergeant Sullivan, gets halfway through his closing speech and then collapses, exhausted by the case, and it's a terrible mess. But Casement remains totally dignified throughout, yeah.
So what were the Black Diaries? How were they discovered? And what use was made of them to ensure that Casement was executed in August of 1916?
So the so-called Black Diaries were Casement's diaries from 1903, the year he did his Congo report, which were in a locked trunk in a lodging he used sometimes in London. And when word got out via Adler Christensen in the first instance that Casement was up to no good in Germany, he started being investigated by the brand new British intelligence services. And they went to his lodgings and found this trunk. And we know they found it then in 1914, because there's something in the intelligence files of trying to find a man called Doubleday, who Casement's been writing a lot of checks for. And they find some of his check recipients are Irish causes and so on. And they get very concerned as to who this man Doubleday might be, some sort of foreign agent. Turns out to be the local fishmonger. But because all this is in the files, we know from 1914 on they'd opened this trunk. When he comes to London in the end of his second interrogation on Easter Monday, the policeman interrogating him says, "We found this trunk, do you have the key?" And Casement says, "Oh, good Lord, no, but force it open, there's nothing in there." So we know that they'd already opened it. And in this 1903 diary, which is really a series of jottings, I mean, it sort of went to Traviata, doesn't say whether he liked it, bought a loaf of bread and so on. But the first 8 weeks of the year he's in London, the rest of it he's doing his Congo trip, and we don't have those pages because they were torn out in 1916, and we'll come on to what use was made of them. But from other entries in the diaries, we can assume it's probably entries such as walked home from the theatre, met a Welshman behind on Hampstead Heath, 7 and 6. So it's simple sort of accounting, really, for these paid homosexual assignations. And after he was condemned to death, and the law had to condemn him to death, there was a huge international outcry to get him reprieved from the gallows. And the Senate in America passed a resolution to get him reprieved. And Conan Doyle and John Galsworthy, all the H.G. Wells, all the great liberal intellectuals wrote a petition to the Prime Minister. The Archbishop of Canterbury made an appeal to the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister, we can see from his papers, was pretty keen to find some way of not executing this hero, and asked his Home Office if there was any way of finding a plea of insanity which would have spared him the gallows. And the British ambassador in Washington was saying, you mustn't hang him because it might, well, the Irish-American lobby is so powerful, it might keep them out of the war. So there was this groundswell of opinion for him. Whether it could have saved him, we'll never know. But the policeman investigating his case was a man called Sir Basil Thompson, and the head of naval intelligence, who'd also interrogated him, chose to photograph these 8 pages of the diaries, and initially, actually before the trial, took them to various newspaper editors, none of whom ran a story. They offered them to his defence team, who said, we don't want to look at this. Everyone was aware just how explosive they were. But after the verdict and after the appeal had failed, these were basically sent around, and word of them got out. The Archbishop of Canterbury retracted his appeal to Prime Minister Asquith. The American ambassador asked for copies of the photographs to be sent to him to use against those people in America who were saying he shouldn't be hanged. And it was a terrible use of material to make sure this support melted away.
What's your own position on the authenticity of the Black Diaries?
I believe they're authentic. They were scientifically proved to be authentic in the year 2000. Bertie Ahern wrote to Tony Blair and said, I think you should get these authenticated, so the debate is removed. And what we do have is all of a piece with what we know of Casement, the other pages in the diary. So I'm in no doubt that they're authentic.
The decision to go ahead with his execution, because as you say, there might possibly have been grounds which could have been found to mitigate the sentence in some way. Politically, how smart was it for the British government to go ahead and to execute Roger Casement months after the executions in Dublin, given the reaction to those executions, the adverse reaction having already set in, and now here they are effectively doubling down, as it were, on what had already happened in Dublin?
They were doubling down. Of course, it was a treason trial, and I thought a lot about this. I suspect they had to execute Casement and would have had to anyway. He'd undeniably performed treason. He'd been in Germany for over a year. But also, we have to remember, it was 1916, the first Battle of the Somme started on the last day of Casement's trial. Germany were such an implacable enemy. Hundreds of thousands of young men were being lost in the war. And I think it would have been very difficult, except for a plea of insanity, to have not executed Casement. I think he'd performed treason, as he himself admitted. I mean, it didn't appear like treason to him because he felt he was doing it in Ireland's cause. But at that crucial time in the war, a bad time in the war, I think it was inevitable he would have been executed.
You point out that he faced his trial with dignity. Did he face his execution with similar dignity?
Yes, he did. He was extraordinary. It's very, very moving, his last conversations and letters. A lot of his letters we'll never see because the British authorities destroyed them, thinking they would be too useful for propaganda purposes. But he knew he'd done everything he could. He was becoming a martyr. He converted to Catholicism the day before his execution and was given the last rites at the same time as his first communion. And he seemed at peace. He was puzzled. He said, I've never done anything to hurt anyone, yet here I am being executed. And he wanted his small family to be okay with it. And it was a very, very moving ending.
Where did you get the title of the book, by the way, Broken Archangel?
Broken Archangel was something T.E. Lawrence of Arabia, said in a letter very shortly before he was killed in his road accident. He wrote to a friend saying, I'm thinking of writing a book about Roger Casement. He seems to me a broken archangel. And, of course, Lawrence of Arabia and Roger Casement had many things in common, slightly shadowy sexual life, but above all, sympathy for the oppressed and colonised.
Finally, was he somebody who today perhaps might be described as having mental health issues?
I think definitely. I think in his time in Germany, he had what was quite clearly a breakdown, Christmas 1915, he was in a sanatorium. It was after Adler Christensen left him, really, and he was completely alone. And yes, he suffered very much from depression in those later years. And I think the energy he put into his great campaigns feels to me like staving off of that depression as he went through his life.
My guest is Roland Phillips. His book is called Broken Archangel, The Tempestuous Lives of Roger Casement. It's published by Bodley Head. Roland, thank you very much indeed for joining us on The History Show.
Thank you for having me on.
That's all we've got time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Mark McGrath on sound and our researcher, Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Logan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.